This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
And that's what we're doing to the atmosphere right now. We're just dumping pollution into the atmosphere and looking the other way. And to tackle climate change, to tackle greenhouse gas emissions, it's going to cost money. You know, you can't get away from that reality. But it also is important to keep in mind the cost of not doing anything.
As summer draws to a close this week on Sea Change Radio, we take a dip into the archives. First, we speak to Ian Power, an assistant professor at Trent University in Ontario, Canada, who's working on a breakthrough in manufacturing a CO2-absorbing mineral called magnesite in a fraction of the time that it forms in nature. We discuss his team's research, learn about the methods they used, and talk about this unusual mineral's potential to fight climate change. Then we hear from Kendra Ulrich, a senior shipping campaigner at Stand, about the downsides of the cruise industry. Ulrich tells us about the hazards presented by enormous cruise ships that float into some of the planet's most fragile ecosystems, the diesel fumes that harm the lungs of the ship's crew and passengers, and the greenwashing that the cruise lines have used in response to allegations of environmental irresponsibility. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Ian Power. Ian is an assistant professor of geosciences at Trent University in Ontario, Canada, where he's also the research chair in environmental geoscience. Ian, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So you're at a conference in Boston right now presenting some pretty fascinating discoveries that you and your colleagues have made recently. Maybe you can briefly summarize these findings before we dive deeper into them.
Sure. Colleagues and I, we've been working on the formation of this mineral, magnesite, and we've been looking at its formation under Earth surface conditions, both looking at it in nature and then also in the laboratory. And what's great about this mineral is that when it forms, it does sequester carbon dioxide, which of course is a greenhouse gas. In our field studies, we try to understand the processes and the mechanisms in which it forms, sort of in these playa environments in northern British Columbia, Canada. And we quantified how quickly it forms, and we showed that it does form quite slowly. But in the laboratory, we were able to accelerate its formation.
So was the intention from the outset of this research to find something that could help reduce CO2 and fight climate change?
Well, there are many researchers looking at different ways in which you might form different carbonate minerals like magnesite. So we're not the first ones to sort of investigate this broad area of research that's going on globally. For example, in the press release, Peter Kellerman, he's looked at formation of magnesite under high temperature conditions. So our research, we were looking at these natural environments as a sort of natural analog for carbon sequestration. Because again, we can learn a lot from nature. Much of the carbon dioxide or carbon on Earth is stored within these carbonate minerals. So if you think about very large like limestone deposits, there's a lot of carbon stored within that material. So, Mother Earth knows how to sequester carbon dioxide over geological times. But the real problem is that we're, of course, emitting so much CO2 into the atmosphere. The Earth can't really keep up with all these emissions.
So magnesite is a mineral that usually takes hundreds or thousands of years to form, and you and your colleagues are able to create it in a few days with this process, Ian. How common is this mineral, magnesite? Is it something we see all around us?
No, it is fairly unique. There are a number of different environments around the world, in China, in Turkey, as a couple of examples. But its formation is fairly rare under Earth surface conditions. You also do find its formation sort of deeper in the crust in places like Oman, for example. But it is pretty unique. You wouldn't just run into it walking, doing a hike.
And how would a geologist recognize it? How is it distinct from a rock like limestone that you just mentioned?
Macroscopically, if you're just visually looking at it, it's a little different. You know, it's white, it's a rock, or it can form as sediments. So in the environment that I'm looking at, it's more, you may have seen the photograph, it's like a white sediment, or it could be a white rock. But yeah, pretty unimpressive to the naked eye.
So take us into the technology that you and your team developed using these polystyrene balls in order to greatly accelerate the time it takes for magnesite to be created. How does it work, and what could it mean in a larger sense in terms of climate change?
Okay. So this was research initiated by Paul Kenward and myself. Previous experiments have shown that these sorts of reactive surfaces can accelerate carbonate formation. With magnesite, as I mentioned, it does form very slowly at sort of ambient conditions, but what these reactive surfaces do is that they sort of disrupt the hydration layer around magnesium ions, which I know seems a bit technical, but it kind of attacks the rate limitation that normally occurs in nature, and it can speed things up quite a lot. So in the natural setting, we estimated that its formation would take hundreds or thousands of years to form. But in the laboratory, we were doing its formation in tens of days. So it's quite a dramatic acceleration.
And how do these polystyrene balls play a role in the process, Ian?
It sort of works as a catalyst, I guess you could think about it in that way. So it's not necessarily being lost during the process, but it's acting as a catalyst. So you can form magnesite using higher temperature reactions. So people are, again, investigating that. But higher temperatures often means more energy input, which also means more expense. And so there's value in kind of looking at alternative ways in which you could form this mineral. And that's why we want to try and use these reactive surfaces as a catalyst to form magnesite at more Earth surface conditions.
When we're talking about this carbon dioxide storing mineral and its unique characteristics, maybe you can compare how efficient it is in storing CO2 to methods that are being developed for CCS, that's carbon capture and sequestration.
Right. So in some of the carbon capture and storage technologies where maybe perhaps people are investigating the idea of injecting supercritical CO2, which is more of a fluid, into the subsurface. The drawback of that sort of technology is that there's the potential for leakage. The great thing about forming carbonate minerals is that it is a solid mineral, right? So you can hold that in your hand. There's no real concern about leakage. So it doesn't necessarily store more carbon dioxide. Obviously, that would depend on the scale that you sort of implement these sorts of technologies. But it's very secure, which is good for long-term storage if you're trying to store carbon dioxide for thousands of years. And it's also quite environmentally safe.
And how would magnesite's CO2 storage capability compare to the photosynthetic properties of trees that convert CO2 to oxygen in terms of removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere?
It may or may not be more efficient than, let's say, a tree storing CO2. But I guess the difficulty with sort of organic matter is, of course, the tree will shed its leaves and potentially die and then release that CO2 through degradation. Whereas a mineral, once the CO2 is locked in there, it's more stable for longer periods of time. It's not going to turn over like the organic biomass of a tree would.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Ian Power. He's a professor of geological sciences at Trent University in Ontario, Canada. So, Ian, I know this isn't part of your usual academic presentation, but if you can try and look a little into the future and dream a bit about the long-term potential of magnesite, what do you foresee it becoming someday, possibly?
Right. Well, firstly, I'll say that, you know, our study was a very small-scale laboratory experiment, so obviously there's a lot of challenges in trying to upscale these results to the sort of industrial scale. So lots of challenges there, but depending on a lot of different factors, but if the price of carbon were high enough and we had technologies that were efficient enough, then we could have a world where we do actively manage and sequester carbon dioxide. In my opinion, you know, there's a million and one ways in which we generate greenhouse gas emissions, and so we really need a million and one ways to manage greenhouse gas emissions. So in a future world, we could have reactors that are connected to power plants and sequestering that point source of CO2. Other people are investigating how we might capture CO2 from the atmosphere. So there's a wide range of potential technologies that might work in different scenarios.
And how would this sequestration work exactly? Would the magnesite be formed in a lab and then put underground to encase a CCS cave of some sort?
Well, in my sort of, based on my research, it was more focused on sort of formation of magnesite at ambient conditions. So again, these could be lower temperature reactor systems where you're forming the mineral. But as I mentioned, people are looking at other different avenues for forming magnesite at depth. So there's a lot of different approaches you could take.
And what was like the light bulb moment when you realized that this mineral was taking shape much faster than you may have speculated?
Well, I was the one that was doing the sort of microscopy after we had sort of conducted the experiments. And so we use a scanning electron microscope, which allows us to image objects that are on the micron or even submicron scale. So very, very tiny. And then I was able to identify these magnesite crystals. And I know from my work in the natural environment that magnesite's a fantastic mineral for storing CO2. And so that was kind of the light bulb moment when we identified it.
And I want to understand, how integral to the accelerated growth of the mineral are these polystyrene balls? Do you think magnesite can grow more rapidly in other scenarios? That is, are you trying to improve the process using different substrates?
We haven't gone there yet, but I think there is potential for using different substrates that, again, have the same sort of mechanism, but could be implemented a bit differently, and those processes could be more efficient, for example, and maybe easier to upscale. So these polystyrene spheres, they do mimic some of the surface properties of certain bacteria. And again, this has been an area of research for myself and others, looking at how bacteria can help form different carbonate minerals. So in some ways, these polystyrene spheres were acting, to mimic the cell surface characteristics. So again, that could be a different avenue where you could potentially have a bacterium that is capable of forming magnesite under certain conditions. That's not something we've explored, but it is a possibility.
So give us an idea of how much magnesite would be needed to make a significant impact to offset the emissions of, let's say, a 250 megawatt coal-fired power plant. And is this something that can potentially be used above ground?
Well, it's not an area of research that I'm involved in, but there are other people looking at what you might use different byproducts for, whether it's magnesite or other carbonate minerals that you might form during carbon sequestration. There's even people investigating ways in which you might transform CO2 into some sort of fuel. So it is an active area of research, trying to come up with ways in which you might create beneficial byproducts while sequestering CO2. So magnesite may have uses sort of in the industrial world, but it's not an area of research that I'm focusing on.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Ian Power. He's a professor of geological sciences at Trent University in Ontario, Canada. So Ian, we're always taught to follow the money when looking at an investment or some emerging technology. What should listeners look for if they're going to be following this technology in terms of this becoming something bigger than a promising mineral being developed in a lab setting? Do you foresee big government agencies, private companies pouring money into this, utilities? What would be kind of a bellwether event for it to really ramp up?
Yeah, that's a big question, and I don't necessarily have a great answer for that. The greenhouse gas emissions that we're emitting at the global scale, it's almost mind-boggling. And it's important to understand that if you really want to tackle this problem, we have to do things at quite a large scale, and it is going to cost money. I recently saw a presentation by Peter Kellerman. He was talking about London, England, before they had sewers, and the spread of disease, and it costs a lot of money to install sewers, right? It costs a lot of money to fix problems, and so it's difficult to get away from that reality. But of course, no one would look back and think that installing sewers in London was a bad idea.
You mean dumping our chamber pots from second story windows onto the streets below wasn't a great plumbing solution?
No, not a solution. And that's what we're doing to the atmosphere right now. We're just dumping pollution into the atmosphere and looking the other way. And to tackle climate change, to tackle greenhouse gas emissions, it's going to cost money. You can't get away from that reality. But it also is important to keep in mind the cost of not doing anything. This year in parts of Canada, and I know in the U.S., there's been some really bad wildfires. Again, you can't necessarily directly link that to climate change, but the summers are getting longer and hotter and drier, and that does result in more forest fires. But that's just one example of the cost of climate change.
Ian Power is an assistant professor of geological sciences at Trent University in Ontario, Canada. Ian, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Kendra Ulrich. She's a senior shipping campaigner for Stand.Earth. Kendra, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
So I wanted to learn a little bit more about the environmental impact of cruise ships, and you and your colleagues have been examining this. What would you say to your parents if they called you up and said, hey, we're thinking of taking a cruise. Would you want to come along?
Well, to answer that, I recently went on my first cruise. It will probably be my last one. I was accompanying Dr. Ryan Kennedy of Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And I will say that the experience was what I expected it to be, which is just simply not my cup of tea. But if my parents were going on a cruise, I would be quite concerned. And that's because there are numerous issues with cruise ships, but particularly the air pollution that we were measuring on board could be as polluted as some of the world's most polluted cities like Beijing and Santiago.
A lot of Bay Area residents became intimately aware of the AQI, the Air Quality Index numbers, and what that means. And we still, Bay Area residents are checking it. Yesterday, for example, it just leapt up into the 150s. What kind of numbers are we seeing on these cruise ships, Kendra?
Sure. Well, there's a slight difference there with the air quality index. That is measuring primarily PM2.5. That is a much larger particle than what we were measuring. What Dr. Kennedy was using was an instrument called a P-TRAC. It measures ultrafine and nano-sized particulates. The ultrafine and nanoparticulate matter closely aligns with the type of particulates that we would expect to see from the combustion of diesel and heavy fuel oil, which is primarily what these ships are using. It is the world's dirtiest fossil fuel. It is the dirtiest thing that's available for marine transportation. The concerning thing about ultrafine and nano-sized particulate matter is that because it is so incredibly small, PM2.5 is already a concern because it can bypass the body's natural defenses. Ultrafine and nano-sized particulates, there are studies that are showing that they may be even more harmful to health than PM2.5, and that's because they can translocate to far regions of the body and far organs of the body. And especially when you're talking about particulate matter from the combustion of a very dirty fuel source like heavy fuel oil, this emissions has significant toxic heavy metals and other dangerous components to it that you definitely don't want in the far reaches of your body.
And you mentioned how passengers on these cruise ships are often exposed to similar air quality to some of the worst cities in the world. Give us an apples to apples comparison then, if we can't do an AQI, these nanoparticulate matters. How does that compare in Beijing, for example?
That's a great question. So the studies that we compared the cruise ship data that we had collected on board four different cruise ships was compared to studies that were done with the exact same instrument, the P-TRAC. So measuring that ultrafine and nano level particulate matter on a busy street in Beijing in a study that was done in 2009, they saw particulate counts of about 30,000 or so. We routinely found at the back of the ship behind the smokestack. And the important thing to understand is that that is the area of the ship where people are encouraged to exercise. So they have running tracks, they have, activity areas for families, et cetera, in the back of the ship behind the smokestacks. We were routinely finding 30,000, high 20s. At some points, we had particulate counts of about 100,000 to 157,000 parts per cubic centimeters of air. And again, going back, we're talking a busy street in Beijing at 30. So this is very, very concerning in terms of a public health risk. And it's not just, of course, the customers that are being exposed, but there are people that are living and working on these ships long term. You know, some people that are on for the majority of the year because they're working there, and the people that are being required to be in that environment may be being exposed to extremely high levels of dangerous constituents in this particulate matter.
When you ran your test, did you see a real stark contrast between the front of these ships and the back, or is it pretty mm-hmm. uniform?
No, that's the important finding of this study, is that, we did the test in the front of the ship to get a baseline, because there's always going to be some, background particulate matter in the air, suspended salt particles, suspended water particles, some dust or other things coming from land-based sources potentially. Each test was done in a series of three. So in the front of the ship, to get that baseline sample, where you would not expect to have any of the ship exhaust while it's underway, while it's moving forward, because, of course, the wind currents are creating a backdraft, carrying pollution to the back of the ship. The difference between the front of the ship and the back of the ship were significant. We had measurements up to 8 times greater in the back of the ship than in the front of the ship. It also smells very much like petroleum product. So it is very clear, of course, that the source of the particulate matter is primarily from the ship's exhaust itself. The readings were so high, though, that even I was surprised. We suspected there might be a problem. We had no idea going into it that it was going to be this significant.
And how do you think this would maybe compare if you looked at the various fleets of, let's say, a princess and a carnival? How standard do you think these findings would be? Or would there be a wide variance, Kendra?
Well, each of the ships is a bit different. Each ship has its own design. We did actually test ships from three different cruise lines. Now, we were testing ships that were all owned by Carnival Corporation, and that's a really important thing to understand. There's a lot of different cruise lines that people think are separate lines that are actually all the same company, effectively. So Princess Cruises, Holland America, and Carnival Cruise Line are all owned by Carnival Corporation. They own 10 brands worldwide. And operate in oceans around the world. And again, most of these ships are being, powered by one of the world's dirtiest fossil fuels. What we found in these studies, we tested, of course, the two Carnival ships, one Holland America ship and one Princess ship, that what we consistently found was that there was extremely elevated levels of particulate matter in the back of the ship. Some of them, for example, the Princess line, were exceedingly high. The smokestack was very, very close to where, literally there was a basketball court behind the smokestack. There was mini golf and putt-putt behind the smokestack, nearly at eye level, just above our heads. But on all the ships, we had very, very high levels, concerning levels, levels that are comparable to Beijing and other places.
Can you foresee some kind of a class action suit for these employees? I mean, we're talking about a customer, as you mentioned, who might just be on there for a week or two versus somebody who's on there 40 weeks a year.
As far as I know, there's been no epidemiological studies of cruise ship employees. One of the very challenging things about this is that most of these cruise lines hire people from developing countries that have weak employee protection laws. And so there are very few protections for the people that are working on these ships in terms of legal avenues they could take to protect their health. In addition to that, one of the things that's quite shocking about all of these cruise ships is that they require, for example, all of their passengers to waive their right to a class action lawsuit, to participate in class action lawsuits. That was something that, we were taking a look at because of the exposure of both employees as well as passengers. And we're quite surprised to see that, they preemptively waive their right. And the vast majority of people getting on these ships are not reading the very lengthy, terms and conditions contracts that they're agreeing to. And they may not even know that they've waived these critical legal rights until, something happens on the ship and they need some legal protection or legal recourse.
Kendra Ulrich, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Creative Source, Steel Pulse, and Taj Mahal.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.